Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Natalia Shpilova-Said. I'm a host of New Books in Eastern European Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm delighted to speak today with Serhii Plohii, author of The Frontline, Essays on Ukraine's Past and Present, published by Harvard Ukrainian Research Institute in 2021. Serhii Plohii is the Mykhailo Hrushevsky Professor of Ukrainian History and the director of the Ukrainian Research Institute at Harvard University. His interests include intellectual, cultural, and international history of Eastern Europe, and political and cultural history of World War II and the Cold War. He is the author of a number of books, including Ukraine and Russia, Representations of the Past, The Last Empire, The Final Days of the Soviet Union, The Gates of Europe, A History of Ukraine, Chernobyl, History of a Tragedy. His books won numerous awards, including the Lionel Gelber Prize for the Best English Language Book on the International Relations and the Bailey Gifford Prize for Nonfiction. Hello, Serhii. Thank you so much for joining me today and congratulations on your most recent book.
Thank you very much, Natalia, and thank you for inviting me for this interview. I really, really appreciate it and look forward to our discussion.
So, The Frontline is a collection of essays which were written initially at different stages of your research career. And in the opening part, you mentioned that this collection documents historical and political developments that you would like to explain to yourself and to your reading audiences. The scope of your research is impressive, but I'm wondering what events or developments have been so far most puzzling to you and confusing to you as a historian and as well as a writer. What historical events ask for the largest amount of side notes? But that's probably how one may feel about the history of Ukraine in general.
Well, most of the essays that appear in the collection were written and published in the last 7 to 10 years. Some of them, a number of them, appear in the collection for the first time. And the last 7 years turned out to be a very, very important period in the history of Ukraine and development of our understanding of Ukraine today and Ukrainian past as well. So 2013, that's the start of the first Euro revolution that turns into the revolution of dignity. 2014 brings the Russian annexation of the Crimea, the start of the war in Donbass that continues till today. And those developments are important in their own right in terms of maybe setting a new agenda for the sort of questions that we ask ourselves about Ukrainian society, Ukrainian politics, and Ukrainian history. But also those events made their way into the mainstream in the West of the Western media, TV, to a degree that Ukraine became central part of the first impeachment of President Trump. The impeachments are not something that happens in the American history every day. The first impeachment of President Trump was the first and the only so far impeachment which was based on the accusation on the mismanagement by the president or violation of his prerogatives in terms of the foreign policy. And Ukraine was right and center in that scandal. So in the last 7 years, one way or another, I and probably others also had to react to this changed atmosphere around and around Ukraine, the growing interest in Ukraine. And in that sense, the essays that are collected in the collection that is called Frontline are a reflection of this of the times that we are living in and the times in which they were written. Again, none of them deals specifically with the events of the last 7 years. Again, there would be references here and there. The essays cover the period of Ukrainian history from the 16th and the early 17th century until the beginning of the 21st century. But the quintessential question that I was trying to answer in those essays, and I didn't realize that when I was writing them, I came to that realization when I was working on putting them together in that collection, was: what is so special about Ukraine? Why Ukraine keeps finding itself at the center of the major international developments and major international controversies as well?
So as you just mentioned, Ukraine has been at the epicenter of the most tumultuous, probably, and disruptive at times events in the history, not only of Europe, but probably we can also say of the world as well. And I really appreciate the collection of maps which are included in this recent publication. But I was curious if there is some sort of dissonance between geographical position of Ukraine and, so to speak, memorial position of Ukraine on the international memorial map. Was Ukraine really visible in terms of international memorial map until recently?
One of my essays, again, the first essay that opens the collection is called Putting Ukraine on the Map of Europe. And it treats that particular statement very literally, in the sense that the essay looks at the first case when Ukraine is mentioned on the map. In that case, that was the map that was sponsored by one of the key figures in the Grand Duchy of Lithuania in the 16th and the beginning of the 17th century. But there is certainly a metaphorical also layer ring to that question as well. And in metaphorical terms, Ukraine appears on the map of memory of Europe, of the world, much later, of course. It is not 16th century, it is not 17th century. It is really, in a major way, I would say, the end of the 20th century, the beginning of the 21st. And it is associated with the fact that, first of all, Ukraine becomes an independent country. And the news of history, clear, one way or another, favors the countries that have their states, what used to be called a historical nation. So Ukraine, for the first time, becomes a sort of a historical nation after 1991, and that's also a ticket to the club of the other nations, and it becomes more visible on the European map and the historical map of the world. What happens in the process is reappropriation of certain themes, of certain subjects that were already on that map, but were not associated with Ukraine. And one of the most obvious cases of that is the history of the Holocaust. And again, the Holocaust was there for a long period of time, at least since 50s and 60s. But it was associated not so much with Ukraine. It was associated certainly with the World War II in general. And when it comes to the Holocaust by bullets, again, a relatively new development, that comes to the fore recently and associated with the Soviet Union or with Russia. The fact that a good part of the Holocaust by bullets is taking place on the territory of Ukraine, this is a new development in terms of thinking, conceptualization, and mapping of certain certain developments. And again, it's a challenge not only for the history of the Second World War, but it's also a change for Ukrainian historians and society at large what to do with that. Another example is the history of the Second World War in general, the history of World War One, when Ukraine was actually basically absent from the narratives of those global events and global developments. But now we have books like the one written by Dominic Levin on the World War One, where there are quite well founded statements that a good part of the World War I on the Eastern Front was fought over the issue of Ukraine and control over Ukraine, something that, again, didn't occur to anybody before last few decades. And final example, which is maybe the closest to my own research and is also related to two essays in the collection, is the history of Chernobyl and Chernobyl nuclear disaster. It exists in the imagination of the world as the worst nuclear disaster that happened at any time in history since the start of the nuclear age. But to what degree this is about Ukraine, to what degree just the nuclear power plants happened to be in Ukraine, that was the question that was not even asked for a long period of time. It's about the history of the nuclear energy in general, about the Soviet Union, about the Cold War, but hardly about Ukraine, when for Ukraine, Chernobyl had a major significance that goes beyond the issues of nuclear energy and served as a trigger for the movement, for the start of the movement for Ukrainian independence, and at the end also end of the Soviet Union. So again, I will not continue with those examples. I can certainly continue. I talk about some of the cases that I discussed here in the book, in the collection, but Ukraine is appearing on the map in a major way for the first time. And it appears in its own right, and it also appears in the way that some parts of history in particular are being reappropriated and reinterpreted. And my collection of essays, I would say, is a step in that direction as part of that broader process. Mm-hmm.
Just to follow up on this comment, you mentioned that Ukraine has to write a new national history, and at the same time, there is a danger of nationalizing history, against which you warn, not only in this collection, but in your previous connection, specifically in Ukraine and Russia representations of the past. So what's this new national history, which is not nationalizing and nationalized?
Yes, the introduction to the collection, I pose a question about the need for writing new national history, not just for Ukraine, but probably thinking about this genre of history writing in general as a new type of genre, sort of reinventing it. Because what happened in the last few decades was really a clash of maybe two different processes and two demands. On the one hand, we see the process of globalization and internationalization of many things, which found its reflection also in thinking about history. And the beginning or attempts to create new kind of history, for example, in the European Union, a sponsored attempt, a new community needs a new understanding of history, and this is absolutely true. And this new understanding of history comes, of course, at the expense of the national history, traditionally written national narratives. But then, by the beginning of the 21st century, a very interesting development happens, and this development is of course it starts in the 1990s, the expansion of the European Union, which welcomes a significant new members from the East in particular, for whom the issue of the national history, national sovereignty, extremely important. They come out of existence of either losing their independence and national sovereignty and stopping being an actor in the international arena altogether. This is the case, for example, of the Baltic states, or having some limited sovereignty, like it was the case with Poland, for example, or Romania, or Hungary, and so on and so forth. They never actually finished the process of the writing and thinking in national terms about their history under communism. So they turned out to be not ready really to move all the way into that stage where the historians of France, the historians of Germany, for that matter, were at that time and at that point. And the question is then, what do you do with this need and drive to new national histories? And this is the trend that is not limited to the Europe only. You look at the entire post-colonial world. You look at the world in which most of the countries are the countries of former colonies that are still going through the process of the formation of their nations and their national narratives. So imposing a particular model of writing of history that developed, let's say, in Europe or in the United States on the rest of the world simply didn't work. And the question is, if it didn't work, what to do next? Like, should we keep pushing in the same direction? Or maybe take a step back and think about what is going on around us and how to deal with those. And my solution for myself, okay, this is a problem, I have to think about it, I have to come up with some it came as a of Ukraine entering the making the headlines in the I was approached by a publisher with the request to write a history of Ukraine. So not history of Eastern Europe, not history of Europe, not history of the world, not history of medicine, not history of nuclear energy. The events put on the agenda the question of what is Ukraine, where did it come from, what the conflict is about, and implicitly the request was write for us a history of national history of that particular country. Like there is history of Germany, or there is history of Romania, or there is history of the United States. And the question was how to write that national history without falling into the pitfalls of the national history of the past, which was very often ethnocentric, which was the history that really prioritized, privileged one ethnic group over another, that used an old and outdated, not just terminology, but also instruments in creating those histories. Again, the national history is being born, we say mostly in the 19th century. So my solution was to bring into the history of Ukraine as a territory, as a society, the achievements from the fields of non-national history as they emerged in the last maybe 50 years. And again, I treated very seriously such thing as a cultural turn. Certainly I was interested in identities. So these are parts that were not part the approaches that were not part of the traditional national history. Elements of international history are there as well. Multi-ethnic history also is a component. I tried to organize all of that around the idea of history of Ukraine as a history of formation and transformation of cultures, political cultures and other cultures. So this is one of the approaches, one of the examples. Again, it is fully reflected in the articles and essays that went into the collection. So again, that was my take on what to do with the national histories at the time when there is a request for them on the part of the societies that are emerging from out of this imperial setting, when there is a demand for that in general public in the United States and in Europe, and they want to know more about the newly created state, and how to deal with this demand and also meet it with this the latest maybe developments or the latest trends that we have in historiography as a whole.
So would you expand a little bit more on this idea of writing probably new national histories, and this issue pertains not only to Ukraine but to other neighbors as well, and particularly it pertains to Russia. You mentioned in your book that Ukrainian history is a battleground, and of course first and foremost we mean all those narratives which are suggested, offered and promoted by Russia today in particular. So how would this repositioning of national history probably, or this reconsideration or rewriting, well, we can use different terms here, could help probably change the focus of how the history of Ukraine is seen and understood globally? I'm asking this question because still, more often than not, the history of Ukraine, unfortunately, is seen through the perspective of those histories and those narratives which are taken from or promoted by the Russian narratives.
Ukrainian history is not unique in that way. Again, the history of almost any nation, any country that emerges out of the imperial setting is, for a long period of time, has been looked at through the prism again of the imperial history. The empires create a lot of narratives, which are quite sophisticated narratives and quite influential narratives in the world. And it certainly takes time for any new country to establish itself, to establish its own identity. And the way how it is done normally is that you go through the historians or the people associated with those countries. Certainly they try talking to the world through the facts, through the interpretations that are already known, and very often they are created by the empires. And the question is how to reinterpret that history of the empires. That is, again, the process that happens on a number of tracks. And one of those tracks is certainly the reinterpretation of the history of the empire by the imperial group, by the imperial nation, by the metropolis itself. And up until the 20th century, all the histories of the empires were written as national histories mostly. And that process of reinterpretation again happens today in Great Britain. It happens in France. It also started to take place in Russia. A group of historians around the journal Ab Imperio put together a two-volume work that is called The New Imperial History. So rewriting the history of Russian Empire as basically imperial history. The first attempt, it's very surprising, but the first attempt to do that came also only in the 1980s and came from outside of Russia and the Soviet Union. Andreas Kaplow wrote the first book of the Russian Empire as an empire. And that is the process that is underway also in Russia. And again, the task is, as we reform our understanding of the history of the post-Soviet space, it's extremely important that the dialogue between the historians in Ukraine, between the historians in the West, and also including as important participants, those historians in Russia virtually are working on the same project, because again it's the reinterpreting of that history, or quote unquote rewriting of that history, is something that that really requires more than one actor in all that story, because whatever history is there, it has to be accepted. It has to be legitimate in the eyes not only of those who create that history, but also in the eyes of the world as a whole, the international community of scholars.
Mm-hmm. So the two chapters of the Frontline focus on Pereyaslav and Hadyč, two trajectories that could present two different historical scenarios for Ukraine. The Pereyaslav scenario, however, became reality, while the Hadyč scenario remained some sort of a lost opportunity for something better. It's interesting how you emphasize this juxtaposition of diametric possibilities. And in this approach, Ukraine is presented in some in-between place. On the other hand, Ukraine was also exercising some influence on other political entities, and this is one of the points that you are emphasizing in your collection in general. Ukraine is and was not only a land that is divided by states, but it is also a political entity that in some way participates in these developments. The issue is, however, how the agency of Ukraine can be revealed and made more visible, while this visibility was not only minimized, but also eliminated over the centuries by Russo-centric historiography that prevailed specifically in the West as well for a long time. So how do we read the Pereyaslav Agreement, for instance, in the way where agency is given not only to Russia?
Pereyaslav Agreement of 1654, this is the start of relations between the Cossack Hetmanate, which later become the foundation for modern Ukraine, and the Tsardom of Moscow, that would later become the foundation for Russia. The sort of the relationship that, of course, lasts till today and the beginning of them is in Pereyaslav in 1654. What is much more clear in Pereyaslav than at any maybe other point in the history of Ukrainian-Russian relations until the revolution and emergence of Ukrainian state in 1918, is that Ukraine enters this relationship on its own terms. And it believes that it enters the relationship that are of a different kind than they eventually turn out to be. When I say on its own terms, is that at the moment of this debates and discussions and before the reaching the agreement in Pereyaslav in 1654, there is a sort of a little scandal takes place in Pereyaslav when the representatives of the Cossack officer elite, and in particular Hetman Bogdan Khmelnytsky, they insist in their negotiations with the representative of the Tsar, Boyar Buturlin, that Buturlin, in the name of the Tsar, would sworn on the oath, make oath on those conditions in the name of the Tsar. And Buturlin refuses to do that because there are Tsars don't do that. And the Cossack officers eventually accept that. But while they rebel again in place in 1658, there would be Cossack uprisings much later, because the Cossacks believed that they were entering the relationship with the Russian Tsar, where each side in that agreement had their own obligations. And the obligation of the Tsar was to protect the rights and privileges of the Cossack class elite and protect Ukraine as a whole. If the Tsar fails to do those things, the deal is off. And that was exactly the argument that Hetman Mazepa put forward in 1708 and 1709, the subject of another essay that went into the collection, where the argument was that the Tsar refused to protect Ukraine against the Swedish invasion. And as the result of that, the deal reached at Pereyaslav doesn't work, doesn't apply anymore. So through all this period between 1654 and 1708, 1709, the Cossack officer class insisted on its own its own interpretation of the agreement. Certainly, it presented itself and was an actor in all that story. The Battle of Poltava, 1709, of course, made a major difference in that entire story. It was a turning point not just in the history of Eastern Europe, but first and foremost in the history of Ukraine. Because the period of maybe unequal relationship, but still negotiations going on between the Cossack Hetmanate and the Russian Tsardom, they came to an end around 1709.
So, and there is another insightful discussion of the history of Rus' in this collection, and this discussion gives some insights into how the figure of Mazepa, for example, could be seen. And you also mentioned Dybowicz's conversation between Great and Little Russia, and these two texts are put into this context of how, in fact, Ukraine could have been seen by by, well, we can say Ukrainians or Malorussi back in the 19th century or 18th century. So I would like to quote one paragraph because your interpretation of the anonymous author of the history of Rus is quite intriguing, particularly in terms of today's politics of memory, and in terms of our understanding of all these memorial contestations, let's put it this way, between Ukraine and Russia. So this is page 84. The anonymous author also emerges from the pages of his history as the first Ukrainian intellectual to struggle with the notion of the religious and ethnic closeness of Russians and Ukrainians. He recognizes the depths of the cultural association between the two nations, but rejects the actions of the popular masses informed by that affinity. Instead, he turns the affinity into his principal weapon, claiming Ukraine's historical primacy as the Rus nation, attributing the Rus name almost exclusively to his compatriots, and trying to shame the Russian state and society into granting equal rights to their little Russian brethren. So I'm wondering what these two documents help reveal in terms of these confrontations that has been going on for centuries today.
Yes, it's a very important development in Ukrainian intellectual history, which sometimes it's difficult really to grasp and understand, partially because you deal with the end that they dealt with the issues of Rus, Russia, Little Russia, Great Russia, and declared themselves to be the true children, the true descendants of Rus. So what does this mean in all this context? How to translate that into the modern language that would be understood in the 20th century? Well, what happened was that the Poltava Battle of 1709 that I just referred to, it put an end to a development of a particular type of the Cossack and Ukrainian identity that dissociated itself from the Rus and origins in Kiev. The Cossacks and Cossack intellectuals developed the idea of the Khazar origins of the Cossacks, separating themselves from Kiev. The Battle of Poltava puts end to that process, which led not just to separation from Kiev, but also separation from the confusion caused by the Rus, Russia, and Moscow at the same time. And the dominant term and identity associated with it becomes Little Russia, where, yes, it is different from Great Russia, but it is still part of a bigger world defined by that term, the world that goes back to the origins of Kievan Rus. And in the 19th century, with the rise of modern nationalism, the new generation of Ukrainian elite they're trying to separate themselves from that connection. And the author of The History of the Rus is the one who tries to do that still within the old paradigm and the old selection of the words. So to do that within the concept of Rus, of broader Rus. And he tries to say that the Cossacks and the Ukrainians are separate people, first of all, but they're being separate, they are more to a degree Rus, Russian or Russian than Russians themselves, because they come from Kiev. So there is a claim for a separate nation in the making, but there is still confusion about the terms. And that confusion really comes to an end later by the second half of the 19th century, when the fathers and mothers of the Ukrainian national project, and there were mothers as well when you look at writers in particular, and Markov of Chok, and Lena Pchilka, and Lesya Ukrainka, and so on and so forth. So fathers and mothers of the Ukrainian modern nation, they decide to leave aside that confusion about Rus and Russia, and who is more Russian and who has more rights for that term and word, and go with the term Ukraine, which became a part of the Ukrainian historical memory, Ukrainian folklore, because it was so closely associated with the Cossack state, with the Hetmanate. And the essay that you refer to, it discusses this moment when Mazepa is rediscovered in the 19th century as a positive figure. And the idea of Ukraine as a separate nation is being emerged, but it's not yet has the names, the labels, the attributes. It's not as recognizable yet as it becomes later in the century.
So another chapter, The Red Century, which is titled The Red Century, and specifically the subchapter, How Russian Was the Russian Revolution, touches upon the formation of the USSR. And the end of this essay, personally, I interpret as some sort of a response to Putin's infamous recent essay, in which he says that Ukrainians received their state only thanks to the Soviet government, which Ukrainians want to break away from today. And there is this another quote that I would like to share. It's page 93. Lenin's victory created a separate republic within the Union for the Russians, endowing them with a territory, institutions, population, and identity distinct from those of the Union as a whole. So it's quite opposite from, to some extent, from what Putin was saying. What was the role of Ukraine in the formation of the USSR, and how legitimate or legitimate is Putin's claim that Ukrainians received their state only thanks to the Soviet Union?
The question is really what was first, the Ukrainian independence or the Soviet Union? Mm-hmm. And the answer to this question is obvious to anyone who knows how to Google and to consult Wikipedia or any other online source. We have certainly two declarations of independence in 1918, the Declaration of the Unity of Ukrainian People's Republic centered in Kiev and Western Ukrainian Republic centered in Lviv and then in Stanislaviv, or Ivano-Frankivsk today, and the Soviet Union is really being a creation of a few years later in 1922. So that's just the facts and chronology. Another question, again, related to that is why the Soviet Union is there. And there were two certainly visions of how the Bolsheviks would legitimize their control over the post-imperial space and how they would organize that space. And one was associated with Joseph Stalin, who argued that it has to be a Russian Federation and it can include other republics as autonomous republics, but basically it would be one Russian state. And there was an alternative vision that was presented and defended by Lenin that there has to be a union state consisting of a number of republics, and Russia would be one of those republics, one of those states. Well, why Lenin takes this position? Lenin takes this position because of the strong response and opposition to Stalin's line that comes from the communist elite. I stress communist elites in two republics, in Georgia and in Ukraine. So they had to be accommodated in some way and form because they rejected the idea of the union. And we are not talking now about Hrushevsky, about Petlura. We are talking about people like Rakovsky and others who basically realized that they were able to establish their control in Ukraine and would continue that control over Ukraine if they make concessions to the Ukrainian national movement. It was already there before the revolution. It acquired momentum during the revolution and forced whoever was the outside force to take it into account. And from that point of view, the recognition of some form of Ukrainian autonomy in the form of the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic, the cultural Ukrainization, those were concessions with the hope of impose full control over the republic and certainly to impose the control of the communist ideology, which was achieved. So that is the story about who created whom and when. Again, Ukraine from that point of view, from that perspective, of course, played a key role in the formation of the Soviet Union, like Ukrainian referendum later in December of 1991 played a key role in the disintegration of the USSR. So I would argue, and that is certainly the argument that I present in the essay, that Ukrainian was central for the existence of the Soviet Union from the very beginning till the end. Again, it's depending on the period. It could be more. It could play more important role or less important role. But it was overall a major factor historically in the history of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Completing this Soviet period or Soviet chapter of your book, you also make a statement that the fall of the USSR is far from being over. And in spite of the fact that it's been more than 30 years chronologically. So what does seem not to be completed so far in terms of the fall of the Soviet Union?
Well, the fact that the Soviet Union has not, the process of its disintegration has not came to an end yet, very obvious when you look certainly at what is happening today in Ukraine. For a long period, and this is war, this is annexation, this is the change of the borders, this is millions of refugees, tens of thousands of people who were killed or wounded. And in 1991, there was this moment of euphoria, end of history, moment to the belief in the victory, final victory of the liberal democracy in the world, where it seemed like the fall of the Soviet Union didn't follow the pattern of the disintegration of other multi-ethnic states and other empires. That it happened basically with not completely without blood. There were, of course, clashes and conflicts in Nagorno-Karabakh. Azerbaijan was involved. There was force used in the Baltics, but it was not, there was no major war. There were no major conflict, at least at the moment of disintegration. And it looked for a while that was it, that was the end. December 26, Gorbachev goes in front of the TV cameras saying that he is resigning because there was no union for him to lead anymore. And that's the end. Well, what followed after that, of course, was Chechnya. What followed after that were conflicts in Moldova. What followed after that was never-ending war between Azerbaijan and Romania. And all of that, unfortunately, fits the pattern of the disintegration of the empires that takes more than it doesn't happen overnight, takes longer period of time. And unfortunately, that process is violent. And continuing war going on in Donbass, with unsettled issues in Moldova, with unsettled issues in relations between Azerbaijan and Armenia, I'm not prepared to declare at that point that the process of the disintegration of the Soviet Union is over. New conflicts can come to the fore, like no one expected the Russian move and annexation of the Crimea, the annexation of the other countries' territory for the first time since the Second World War. So unfortunately, there can be other surprises like that in the future. And the borders of Russian Federation also are not stable. If you look at Chechnya and what is happening there, this is really de facto already not just an autonomous state, but a semi-independent state. So there questions remain as well.
So I would like to shift our focus to education, maybe, just for our final question. There is this long-lasting attempt, particularly over the last 30 years, to make the Ukrainian narrative more visible, and the current Russo-Ukrainian war is very eloquent in this case. The tradition that developed in the West to focus solely on the study of Russia is slow to change, and very often those who start studying the region in general will ask this question: how different Ukraine is from Russia? And it's very often based on the language issue as well. But you also, we didn't touch upon that section, but in your book, you also discussed the Chernobyl tragedy, and you mentioned all those media productions which were created around the tragedy, and you mentioned the Russian Woodpecker and HBO series, well-known HBO series, and still, those are not Ukrainian voices. And those, well, particularly in terms of the Russian narratives, those are not Ukrainian narratives. And unfortunately, this tragedy that took place in Ukraine in the first place is known, again, in the context of Russia. And Ukraine, again, remains a little bit invisible in this conversation very often, unfortunately. So, of course, there is some politics in this question, but still, it's also a challenge for educational programs. How does Ukraine make its voice more distinct without being muted by the Russian version, which seems to persevere, to preserve its power, partially because this is the version with which many are familiar, because that's the primary interest when they study the region. But again, even when the focus shifts to Ukraine, the perspective is somehow distorted through the Russian narratives.
This is certainly true, but I would say that it is changing, especially in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
The tendency that I see in the course of the, especially the last 5, 6, 7 years, is more visibility of Ukraine. We started our discussion with that, about putting Ukraine on the map of memory, but also on the map of imagination of the world. What is basically lacking so far, and has been lacking so far, was the active position of the Ukrainian state.
Mm-hmm.
Which only now awakes to the understanding that spreading knowledge about the country, about its culture, about its history, about its politics, it's an important part of being an independent state. So Ukrainians only learn to live in the independent state and use all the advantages that come with that. So in the last 2 or 3 years, we have emergence of the institutions that actually think that this is important task to perform in terms of the public diplomacy. So again, the situation changes. It changes maybe sometimes on the margins. And one of the problems and one of the issues is that relatively few people and intellectuals in Ukraine actually are able to communicate effectively with the rest of the world. And again, that is something that can be changed overnight. This is a process, sometimes the process that involves change of the generations. But despite all the difficulties, I'm quite optimistic when it comes to the future in terms of Ukraine establishing its own identity in the minds of the intellectuals, in the mind of the academic community, in the mind of the public at large. I think it will not happen overnight, as I said, but it will happen, and we already seen that happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Sergei, for this conversation. And again, congratulations on your book. And thank you for your book that offers a comprehensive commentary on the most contested and controversial issues, and that attempts to inscribe Ukraine in a broader global historical and political context. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Natalia. It was a real pleasure.
Today, I spoke with Sergei Plohy, author of the Frontline Essays on Ukraine's Past and Present, published by Harvard Ukrainian Research Institute in 2021. Thank you for listening to New Books in Eastern European Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.